Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, November 17th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, City of Arcata asks water customers to conserve water November 18th and 20th for Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District repairs, arrests made after standoff in Carlotta, Cal Poly Humboldt students investigate sustainability claims of campus dining provider Chartwell. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Today, the City of Arcata sent a release asking water customers in the area to conserve their water usage on the 18th and the 20th, while the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District makes repairs on their water tanks and gives them a seismic retrofit. KMUD News spoke to Michiko Mares, General Manager for Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District, for more information.
This is work to complete a capital improvement project for a seismic retrofit of several of our water tanks for Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District. And these last work is to install some seismic couplers at a tank so that in the event of a seismic event, we don't lose the pipeline connected to the tank. That's a project that has been funded by our project budget that is an investment in infrastructure to assure reliability and redundancy.
Capital improvement projects are part of the wider capital improvement plan that was finalized in February of 2017 to improve and maintain infrastructure. Customers are being asked to conserve water during this time so that Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District can maintain adequate water supply and fire protection while maintenance is being completed.
In order for us to complete this construction work, we won't be able to produce and deliver water during this window of time. So the different municipalities and communities will be relying on the storage of their municipalities.
During this time, customers can minimize water usage by avoiding outdoor watering or irrigation, car washing, bulk water use of any kind, and any non-essential indoor or outdoor water use. Water outages are not anticipated during the repairs.
If there were some unforeseen event that occurred during the construction, you know, there's always a chance that the construction work could take longer than anticipated, but we do not anticipate that happening at this time. They can minimize their water usage by, you know, perhaps not doing laundry or, you know, limiting their showers to 5 minutes instead of 10 minutes. You know, it all makes a difference. But again, this is a very narrow window of time and it should not impact customers.
To report leaks or water concerns within Arcata, the number for the City of Arcata Environmental Services Department is 707-822-8184. An update on road condition following last week's storm. After last week's storm, several roads around Humboldt County have been left flooded. In a roads condition notification from the Humboldt County Public Works Roads Division, it was stated that the intersection of Hookton Road and Eel River Drive in Hookton is closed due to flooding. Elk River Road before Ridley Road in Eureka, Old Arcata Road between Graham Road and Jacoby Creek in Bayside, Meridian Road, point marker 0.5 to 0.9, and Ambrosini Lane in Ferndale, Freshwater Road west of Garfield School between Howard Heights and Foster Road, and also east of Myrtle, and Coffee Creek Road post mile 0.9 to 1.1 are all flooded. Be sure to drive safely and check road conditions before you travel. For up-to-date road information, the website for Caltrans is dot.ca.gov. Yesterday, November 16th, at approximately 12:33 a.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies responded to a reported physical assault to a residence in Carlotta. Deputies were advised that the suspect, 43-year-old Matthew Warren Bowen, had physically attacked his 70-year-old mother and fled the scene. KMUD News spoke to Aaron Inskip, Public Information Officer for the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, for more information on the incident.
On November 16th, 2025, at approximately 12:33 a.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to a residence in the 7300 block of State Highway 36 in Carlotta for a reported physical assault. While en route, deputies were advised that the suspect had attacked his 70-year-old mother and fled the scene. Upon arrival, deputies contacted the 70-year-old female victim, who reported that her son, 43-year-old Matthew Warren Bowen, had physically attacked her. She told deputies that she attempted to lock herself in a bedroom to prevent further assault, but Bowen forced his way inside, struck her multiple times, and slammed her into the furniture. The victim sustained minor injuries and did not require immediate medical attention. Deputies contacted the on-call judge, who granted an emergency protective order for the victim. Deputies searched the surrounding area for Bowen, but he was not located. At approximately 8:06 a.m., deputies were dispatched back to the residence after a neighbor called the Humboldt County Emergency Communications Center to report that Bowen had returned. Upon arrival, deputies searched the property and eventually located Bowen hiding in a crawl space underneath the house. He refused multiple commands to exit, and after several hours of negotiations, deputies sought a warrant for his arrest. Once the warrant was obtained, deputies again attempted to get Bowen to surrender, but he continued to refuse. And deputies then deployed less lethal chemical agents into the crawl space. Bowen subsequently exited the crawl space and surrendered to deputies without further incident. He was transported to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where he was booked on the following charges: violation of a domestic violence court order, cause injury to a dependent adult, violation of probation, resist and obstruct a peace officer, an assault likely to produce great bodily injury.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office asks that anyone with information about this case or related criminal activity is encouraged to call them at 707-445-7251 or the Sheriff's Office Crime Tip Line at 707-268-2539. Cal Poly Humboldt journalism students investigated the sustainability claims of Cal Poly Humboldt's dining provider, Chartwell's. For over 11 months, students investigated and found discrepancies between Chartwell's promises and practices, including lack of local vendors, mislabeling of recyclable items, and carbon emissions from outsourcing produce, Gabriel Zucker reports.
Over the last 11 months, Cal Poly Humboldt journalism students in an investigative reporting class taught by Matt Drange and Thaddeus Greenson conducted a reporting project on the sustainability claims of Chartwell's, the dining service provider for Cal Poly Humboldt, who just got their contract extended for the next 20 years. During their investigation, the students conducted interviews with a litany of sources and combed through all of the data they could find. After the class was complete, three students, Marianne Casas Perez, Noel DeBlado, and Griffin Mancuso, continued the research until they had enough information to complete the story, releasing the full report this week. An email from Professor Greenson, one of the professors of the class, included an overview of the students' report and shared their findings. This included reviewing the school's contract with the dining service provider Chartwell's, especially with financial and sustainability provisions of the contract. The students reviewed financial records related to the food delivery of Cal Poly Humboldt and all other California State Universities. They also conducted price comparisons of food products on and off campus, and then surveyed students about their impressions of food service on campus and spoke to officials involved in the delivery of food services on campus. Two of the students that finished the project, Noel DeBlado and Griffin Mancuso, explained the process of the class, the timeline of the investigation, and their findings.
So we came to the investigative reporting class, and our professors, Matt Drange and Thad Greenson, already had a plan to do a topic of about dining. And so we all came together. There were about like 10 of us in the class, and we all came together and pitched different ideas that related to dining. And we decided on sustainability and environmental efforts as the main topic of the main angle we wanted to pursue, because all of us felt very passionate about that angle. But yeah, we started with a big list of different ideas, but ultimately we decided that that was a road that we all were passionate about taking. And so we did a ton of different reading through documents, researching, talking to a lot of people, a lot of students, a lot of people related to the university and people outside of the university that had ties to dining. And we talked to other CSU campuses as well. And we gathered a ton of information and had to go and sift through all of that to find what was most important. What did readers really need to know? And go back on all of that information and verify once again and get everybody's perspectives in as much as possible.
Yeah, I think through that, you know, long process of combing through tons of data, tons of documents, talking to tons of people from within and outside of the university, we found that generally the promises of sustainability and claims of sustainability practices within dining services are not matching up with the reality. Primarily, we found that under Chartwell's, which is the company currently in charge of Cal Poly Humboldt's dining services, they are not working with as many local vendors as they claim to be. There is a group here called Harvest Hub, which is a part of the North Coast Growers Association, and they previously worked with the university, and as soon as Chartwell's took over, they did not receive any responses about becoming a vendor again, despite multiple attempts to reach out to them. And only once we started working on this article did the university finally schedule a meeting with them about becoming a vendor. We also found they're primarily sourcing from Sysco, which is a giant vendor that is generally sourced from larger cities. So Cal Poly Humboldt is sourcing a majority of their produce from a Sysco hub in Sacramento. And one trip from one Sysco truck to Cal Poly Humboldt emits about 0.55 tons of carbon dioxide. And that's the equivalent of charging, I have the number here, 44,466 smartphones. And that's not even factoring in the weight of the produce. So it's not the most sustainable option they could be choosing, even if it is cheaper. They also claim to be working on eliminating single-use plastics from dining services and different stores on campus. And one of our reporters found that there are over 200 single-use plastics in the campus marketplace. And there's just a general lack of data available on the university's sustainability practices, especially when it comes to food recovery and food prep. They claim to be rigorously documenting how much food waste is being generated by the university. And after multiple requests through email and info over the phone and in person by several reporters, we never received anything. So that's another big question mark that happened in this story.
And then another big thing, I interviewed who was the program leader at the time last spring or this spring. She was the Cal Poly Humboldt Waste Reduction Resource Awareness Program leader. And this is a group on campus that is trying to push more environmental and sustainable efforts within the campus. And they used to do things like going to dorms and taking people's recyclable plastics, all of that kind of stuff. And she informed us that a lot of the lids and coffee cups that were used in the marketplace, the depot, any place that had kind of like a cafe, the library cafe as well. They often had cups that were labeled recyclable or lids that were claimed to be recyclable, but there is a plastic lining coating within all of these items that are being used that is actually not recyclable, and it can only be industrially composted. So that has to do like, be taken somewhere outside of Humboldt to be completely broken down. And that again takes a lot of energy and emits a lot of greenhouse gases as well. And you know, it's one of those things where you think you're doing a good thing by having a cup that says recycle me or something like that, or has a logo on it as well. And then come to find out that it's a lot more effort than you initially thought to really break it down.
Originally, the project was supposed to take just one semester to complete, but the investigation was incomplete. Doblado, Mancuso, and Casas Perez continued the research after the class had ended, in total taking 11 months to complete the full report. Mancuso and Doblado explained the timeline.
Yeah, I think the original, like, ideal publication date was going to be May 17th of this year. And by the time the semester ended, there was just like, there were a handful of loose ends that we still needed to kind of follow up on so that the story was really solid and that we knew what we were talking about and we were ready to publish this information no matter what the response was. And it was, with this class in particular, we were only able to meet in person for like longer form workshops 4 times in the semester just because of, funding in the department and the way that the schedule was laid out. So it was hard to kind of coordinate with 9 other people and our two editors by only meeting in person four times. So it was a very rewarding experience, but we work with what we have, and I'm happy that it came together with the hard work of all of our amazing reporters and our editors.
Yeah, and this whole story spanned 11 months. We started in January and it just came out this week in November. And so, yeah, it was a very rewarding experience, but I know it seems like a really long time to devote to a story. But regardless of that, I'm still very grateful that I, pursued this still with Griffin and Marianne to the end, because it was an important story. And when we realized at the end of semester that it wasn't where we needed it to be and that we wouldn't get it published, I was sad. I was really sad about it. And I was open to just doing whatever I could to get it out there. And so I'm very glad that I got to work with so many wonderful people across the journalism department to get out an important story.
Overall, this was a rewarding and fulfilling experience for the students involved, learning from professors that had experience in investigative journalism and turning that support into a full-blown investigation.
They were both just incredible reporters and mentors, and I'm very grateful that I took the class and I signed up for it. It was a last minute decision to take the class, and I'm really grateful that I did take the time to add it to my schedule because I feel like I learned so much from them. And they're both fabulous reporters, and I think investigative reporting, there's so much that goes into it, and there's a lot that you have to consider when doing reporting and how you talk to people and how you gather and refine information. And they did an incredible job teaching us all the steps that it takes to really produce an impactful, long form, and intense story like this. And so, yeah, I'm just absolutely grateful to them for their mentorship and their support because technically their job and their role ended at the end of the semester, but they decided to see the story through with us because they believed in it and they believed in us. And I think that just means the whole world to me.
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed the class myself as well. I think it was really interesting to have two professors slash editors coming from such similar and different backgrounds at the same time. I mean, with Thad, he's, very well established in the community here, very well known local journalist, formerly worked for the North Coast Journal as their news editor. And then Matt Drange, our other professor, he also graduated from Cal Poly Humboldt and then went on to work for more national publications like Business Insider. So both of their perspectives working for such different publications was, I think it really enhanced the learning experience. I mean, we just learned a ton of different, advice and how to kind of approach unexpected situations when it comes to the giant labyrinth of investigative reporting. I particularly enjoyed we would role play interviewing difficult sources because that's usually the hardest part for people getting into investigative reporting is, the being difficult. So Thad and Matt would take turns being some difficult source or like a PR representative or a PIO that just doesn't really want to give that much information and how to kind of navigate that and obtain what you can. And each time we'd get a little bit closer to getting little tidbits of information that could help us keep going. So it was super cool. I really enjoyed it.
The report was just published, so the school has not released a statement yet of the findings. This article was a learning experience for all involved and turned into a full-blown investigation that took almost a year to complete. This is Gabriel Zucker with KMUD News.
In state news, schools celebrate non-teaching staff during American Education Week. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Many of us have fond memories of our school days with favorite teachers, but also people like bus drivers, lunch servers, and yard workers who made a real difference. This Wednesday is Educational Support Professionals Day, part of American Education Week, which celebrates non-teaching staff in schools. California schools depend on hundreds of thousands of so-called ESPs, from janitors to school secretaries. David Goldberg is president of the California Teachers Association.
They're a vital part of serving students and our communities. They're on the front lines in all of our efforts. They're really the eyes and ears of the community. It's something that districts really rely on.
California has created career pathways for ESPs through its paraprofessional teacher preparation program, along with professional learning initiatives through the California Department of Education. Many districts have formal recognition programs for non-teaching staff as well. There's new focus on ESPs because it's been a chaotic year for K-12 schools. For example, President Trump has threatened to withhold funding from schools that have diversity initiatives. Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, laments the Trump administration's decision to gut the Department of Education and encourages people to support leaders who value public schools.
During American Education Week, we celebrate wonderful, inspiring things that happen, but we also need to be reminded that we have the power to demand what our students need and what our educators deserve.
Last summer, the Department of Education significantly delayed almost $7 billion in grants that fund professional development for teachers, after-school programs, summer learning, English language classes, support for migrant students, school-based mental health programs, and adult education. At the time, an official from the Office of Management and Budget said, quote, "Initial findings have shown that many of these grant programs have been grossly misused to subsidize a radical left-wing agenda." For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, shutdown agreement promises vote on Affordable Care Act subsidies. Many Democrats skeptical. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
When Republican lawmakers, along with a handful of Democrats, passed a Republican bill to reopen the federal government, they did it without giving in to Democrats' demands for action to prevent health care cuts and the end of Obamacare subsidies. The question now, what to do next? Senate Democratic Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois has an optimistic take on the situation.
I think we've set the stage for a bipartisan approach to this issue in the Senate, and I think we can build on that.
Durbin is one of a handful of Democrats that joined Senate Republicans to end the shutdown. He's been criticized for that vote, but he says he hopes that will not divide Democrats.
I hope that we can close ranks now, even though we had that fundamental disagreement, and work toward a common goal.
He's banking on a Republican promise to take up the Affordable Care Act subsidies later.
Well, the good news is there's a commitment from John Thune, the Republican leader in the Senate, for us to bring a Democratic written bill to the floor before the middle of December, just a matter of a few weeks, and so we can have a debate. What we're doing now, what I'm doing and the other members, is trying to round up Republican support for this. This health care issue is a critical issue that needs to be resolved. We need to extend the tax credit for at least a year, I hope even longer, and make some positive changes in the program.
Other Democrats put less faith in Republican promises these days, especially because the Republican House Speaker has refused to promise a House vote on the issue. Democratic Congressmember Ruben Gallego of Arizona made health care affordability the main topic of a town hall meeting with constituents in Tucson. He recalled the late Arizona Senator John McCain's dramatic vote to block a Republican repeal of Obamacare.
Right now, what we're asking for is, again, political courage. And I actually don't even think it takes that much courage to say, I want to protect 24 million Americans from having their insurance rates premiums doubled.
Without congressional action, Obamacare insurance premiums are set to skyrocket. How much depends on different factors, but for many, the rate hikes will be dramatic.
We're hearing about $400,000, $500,000 a month for some families. You know, there's one family up in Gilbert, Arizona that I met, Mr. Gomez, and, you know, a family of four. You know, he has his own job. He has his own contracting job. He is, you know, paying his taxes. He's buying the ACA. You know, he just got his estimate back, and his increase is going to be more than $3,000 a month, right? No one can withstand that. No one can withstand that.
And why are those rate hikes happening? Gallego says it's because of how Republicans feel about Obamacare.
This is an option that my colleagues on the right are taking because they dislike the ACA. They hate the Affordable Health Care Act, and this is a step one to start destroying that. But the problem with that is this isn't a policy thing. This isn't something you just get to talk to in a theoretical world. You are affecting people's lives.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native American woman and her family are thankful that she's not detained and potentially deported by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has the story.
On Veterans Day, 24-year-old Letitia Jacobo completed a short sentence at the Polk County Jail in Des Moines, Iowa, for a traffic infraction. She was supposed to have been released at midnight, but things took an odd turn.
I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to put it in words. It was shocking. I was like, how do I have a ICE hold and I'm Native American? It was just weird. It was just crazy.
Jacobo's mom, Erica Burns, learned that her daughter was placed under an ICE detainer and was worried. Both women are members of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community and therefore legal U.S. citizens. Jacobo's aunt, Maria Nunez, said her sister sprung into action.
Being the holiday that day, we couldn't do much. And here on her reservation side of the family was jumped on the media and reached out to everyone and whoever we could, because we didn't want her removed and sent to we don't know where.
Nunez says the tribal police chief called into corrections officials to vouch for Jacobo's citizenship. And an investigator learned that another inmate at the jail had the same last name as Jacobo. A spokesman for the Polk County Sheriff's Office said it was all a clerical mix-up, and staff have been talked to about preventing repeat errors. Again, Letitia Jacobo.
I'm very thankful for having family members and people out here, because if I didn't, who knows what would have happened. I would have just unknowingly went to ICE custody. So it would have been a scary moment.
Many Native people and supporters are calling this a case of racial profiling, and Jacobo is weighing a lawsuit. For now, though, she plans to celebrate the holiday season with her family. Maria Nunez says she's happy that her niece is safe.
I'm just so proud to be Native American and have all the love and support in knowing that we're all ready to fight and protect what's ours.
Since the Trump administration ramped up its immigration crackdown, tribes have complained of ICE confronting their enrolled citizens. Many have issued guidance on their rights and what documentation to present if detained. Neither the Des Moines ICE office nor the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community returned requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Colorado River has long been considered a lifeline for the Southwest. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, one Arizona tribe is now acknowledging the waterway as having the same rights and legal protections as tribal members.
The Colorado River Indian Tribes, or CRIT, would not say whether it was unanimous, but the 9 council members still voted to recognize personhood for the namesake river under tribal law. It comes at a pivotal time when sustained drought threatens this natural resource CRIT considers a living entity, running parallel to the tribe's nearly 300,000-acre reservation along the California border. This measure also tasked tribal councils to take the Colorado River's needs under consideration amid an uncertain future on 2 fronts, climate change and ongoing water negotiations. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in Seattle for the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention and Marketplace. Leaders are tackling top issues facing their communities, from economic development, education, climate, to language and culture. Additionally, a youth convention is taking place. Both gatherings continue through Friday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.